to call people to order, and I don't have a huge booming voice, but I'll do the best that I can. I guess it's been about 2 years ago that Holden Village received a grant from the Lilly Foundation for work around vocation to help remodel Koinonia, which is where we're sitting in, to hire Brad Kamach to do partnership between Holden Village and colleges and universities, and a few other components as well to the Holden mission. And one of those small components to the Lilly grant that Holden received was to help Holden reflect on how it's been a place of mentoring for young adults, renewal and reflection for adults, and nurturing for children throughout its history. And one of the ways that was requested by Holden Village to do this was to have two convocations. And the convocations bringing together between roughly 24 and 30 people, somewhere around there, 25, 30 people, who came from different eras of Holden Village, who either grew up here as children, who came here as young adults, or who came as adults either as staff or sabbatical or renewal participants, but who kind of reflect on how Holden Village affected them while they were at the village, but then also, in a sense, how they took a little piece of Holden Village down the mountain with them and incorporated it into their lives. And the first of those convocations are going on right now. So Sunday, about 28 people that fit those descriptions arrived in the village, and they've been spending the last few days reflecting on some questions and sharing their stories, and hopefully over the course of the next two and a half years, those stories will be collected and gathered and made available in more of a public document about that would kind of summarize and look at some of the trends in Holden's history of how Holden has served as a mentoring community, a place of renewal, and a place of nurturing, and a place of reflection. Even though the contours and flavors of what that means may have changed from generation to generation. One of the things that was requested by Holden Village during the convocation was some opportunities for people who were here during the convocation to interface formally and informally with the people who were part of the convocation and the people who were part of the larger Holden Village community, either staff members or guests. And so this is one of those opportunities. And what they had suggested was to have three or four of the people who were here for the convocation, each of whom were here at different time periods, come in and share at least one experience about how Holden impacted them while they were here at the village, and then one way or so how they tried to incorporate that back into their lives down the mountain. And then after they've gotten a chance to reflect, also recognizing that there's both other people with stories to share here who are not part of the convocation, and also people who are part of the convocation who are in the audience who also have stories to share, just to kind of open it up for questions and other people to share their sort of stories of how they were affected by Holden Village and how they've tried to carry a little piece of Holden Village and kind of the commitments and morals here down with them in their lives down the mountain. And so the people that have agreed to get us started with the conversation are Joel, who is wearing the wonderful shirt there, Margaret Lovejoy, who is here wearing a wonderful sweatshirt. I want to keep you in the way. Herb, who's here.
Eyes deceive you.
Herb, who's wearing a fantastic necklace. And then Kristen, whose hair I just love. We thought we would just go in order, just starting with Joel and just right down the line. And they will just kick things off, and then hopefully other people can share their own reflections and stories. And, of course, questions back and forth. So, Joel, if you wouldn't mind.
Sure. Thanks, Paul. Joel Pui, I was here in the village in 1973-74 in the Lifestyle Enrichment Program. It was a post-high school, folk school experience. And sort of the frame, my experience was thinking of the sort of the vogue that is happening throughout the world these days in businesses and in churches and individuals, and that is to write mission statements and purpose statements. And as I thought of that, also about my experience here, mindful that I think God has a purpose statement or a mission statement for his relationship with people, and it really affected and impacted my experience here. And that is, I think it's from the Old Testament, Deuteronomy 6:4. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, etc., etc., etc. But I think really the key thing that God has communicated with that one verse is that one word, hear, or listen. From the beginning of Genesis to the very end, and Jesus incarnate God, the key thing that God wants us to do is to listen. For me personally, that year, back in 73, 74, what happened is I learned how to listen in that experience here at Holden Village. Sometimes that experience of listening was dramatic, like the Howsound Mine Company. They drilled right into Copper Mountain to get out the copper ore, and some of the conversations that I had here at Holden Village were very dramatic, percussive. In the scripture studies that we had, in the topical and the book discussions as a student in the lifestyle, they just bored into my ears as God dug a hole so I would listen to what God had to say. Sometimes it was very soft, like the gradual, you know, the glaciers that have formed this valley. And one of the wonderful things about Holden is that if you come up here, something that is apparent to everybody is the wonderful sound of the wind in the trees is just magical. Or the rumbling of the water down Railroad Creek. Just to hear what God is doing in this place. But probably other things, and as we've been talking to the group who have been here in the 70s, laughter. I heard laughter so much during the year that I was here. In the skits and in the plays, the music we heard, the singing before a meal or after a meal, the madrigals, we had a bit of that this evening in the worship we did. But perhaps the most profound thing for me in 73, 74 was I heard proclamation. It was a song that was sung continually, whether it was in worship and outside of worship. And the two things that I heard in this proclamation was the crazy incarnation of God, that he showed up here on earth. And he was here in the valley and walking with one of us. And then also the pain and the victory of the cross. The incarnation and the resurrection promise was just constantly embedded in the community here. What happened was that I heard, as I was learning how to listen to God, I heard a love song. And I was written into that love song, and it seeped into my bones. And as you hear music, whether it's opera or country music or whatever it is, when you hear music and it's attached to you, it owns you and it possesses you and it gets inside of you. The difficulty, of course, is how do you take such a profound song, the lyrics of love that God has for you in this valley, in this experience, when you leave this place? And today, just reminded me, you know, standing out by the bus is one of the most painful things about Holden for me, is saying goodbye to people or being on the bus and waving goodbye. And I dread, I mean, we're just here briefly, we're leaving on Friday. But Paul, you had asked, you know, talking about what is the impact and how do you leave it from here. Real life experience that when we were here, we were able to practice that. Talked to Marco and Will, two of my folks who were here, and my wife Sarah, that experienced that. We went out skiing in Wenatchee for a 25-kilometer cross-country ski race. We left the village to do this event. There were hundreds, if not 1,000, people on that ski event. The Chinook winds, if you're here during the winter times, you know, it's just wonderful snowing, and then all of a sudden these warm winds come and it melts everything. We went out expecting to ski in nice snow, and the Chinook winds came in, and instead of cross-country skiing, it would have been more likely to go water skiing. I mean, the conditions were horrible. Briefly, go up the ski hill. Randy, who was, I shouldn't have said his name, strike it from the record. One of the fellow folks on the...
Randy, not his real name.
That's right. Alias somebody else. I was skiing along on this cross-country ski race, and this alias fellow by the name of Randy, he comes up behind me and he calls, passing, passing, in the left, you know, track, and as he goes by, I was shocked because he lifted up his ski pole, his cross-country ski pole, and intentionally swung it towards me and knocked me to the ground. I fell into the snow, and my first impressions were shock, embarrassment, and then rage and anger. Got myself up, brushed the snow off, and I took after Randy. Had to catch up to him, and I caught up to him. I said, passing, and I went by him, and as I was coming by, he tried it again, and he swung his pole, and I ducked like this, and he whirlbirded, and he swung, and he fell, and in his own effort, he fell down, and I passed him. I hated that race. Here I was skiing, and I was constantly looking back, waiting for Randy to catch up to me. And in that panic, and in that anxiety, a voice came to me. And it was the voice of my cross-country ski coach who was here at the time, Johan Hinderle. Johan recently ordained, was the village pastor for a while, and he would take a bunch of us out cross-country skiing on the Goat Trail and around here. And I remember what Johan said, when you ski, never look back about your opponent or your contestants. Don't look down in the track, but look to the horizon where you're going. Ski forward. And I kept that, and I kept Johan's voice, my coach, in my head and in my heart. Eventually finished the race in some sort of mental stability. So that has been a metaphor for me of how I've been able to take and trying to take hold and what I've heard here, what God has done in my heart in that year. And that is, life is like a race. You know, you don't get to choose your conditions. A lot of uphill, a lot of downhill. Sometimes it gets real warm, and it just is rotten. And guess what? Sometimes the people that are near and dear to you try to knock you down. But the thing is that what happens here is that, what happened to me, is that I was able to hear God's voice. And God's voice in the proclamation is, as Paul said, I press on to the goal. And Jesus has made all things known. And here I get to forget the stuff in the past. And I don't have to look around anymore, but I can look forward to what God has in store for me. A new day, a new promise, a new gift. As, you know, I'm back here reminiscing and talking with folks from near and far. One of the things that I've been able to re-experience again is that God dwells in this valley in a special way, but not just here, because that Holy Spirit, that paraclete, literally parakaleo, one who runs alongside, who calls alongside, who whispers in your ear and your heart like a coach, is all over the place. But Holden allowed me and enabled me to listen, whether it was in laughter or dancing or singing or whatever was going on here. God was speaking through all of those voices and sounds, and he does out in the other world, the world where we spend most of our time. And so that was a gift that this community was able to give to me, carved out ears to hear God's promise and the urging of the paraclete, that Holy Spirit. And says, keep your eyes on Jesus, what he is making forward for you in the future. So, sort of in a summary, kind of a fashion of Paul and others, that's a little capsule of what Holden was and how I was able to take it down the hill and away.
Okay. Margaret Lovejoy from St. Paul, Minnesota. I was at Holden 83-84 with four of my children, and then I was here 92-94 with two of my children. Eliminated two. They aged out of coming with me. When I came here, because Will Mochan showed me some wonderful slides, and I was looking for and needing a change in my life. I was coming out of a divorce, and just had this feeling that God had something more for me than sitting in a church being a secretary. And I didn't know what that was, but had the faith and trust in the God that I prayed to that God would not mislead me. So I arrived in Wenatchee at 5 a.m. with four children, 13 pieces of luggage, a pair of skis, and fear. Just that knowing that Holden Village would not just let me come into Wenatchee without someone coming from the village to meet me. Mm-hmm. That I would get to Wenatchee and someone would be there with a car and they would take me someplace. Well, instead, there was a very nice policeman at the train station that said, wait, I'll call a cab for you to take you to the bus station, which was not open yet. And we sat outside and waited, trying to be a brave mother, I said to my children, well, let's all go for a walk. And my then 16-year-old son said, we're at a bus station. I don't think it's time to go for a walk. So we got on the bus and got to the boat after trying to cross the street in Chelan with four kids, 13 pieces of luggage, and a pair of skis. And you know, you have to, they let you off on one side of the road and you had to cross to the other, and I felt like this thing crossing the road and I was going to be hit by something. We got to the boat and went up, and this tall, thin man met us and said, welcome. And I said, well, thank you. And who are you? And this was John Schramm, who I'd been communicating some with. And but the director of this place is driving a bus. Where am I going? What am I going to find? Got here, and it was okay. It was okay. My parents thought I was going into a cult, of course. And they came to check on me at Christmas time. And we had the Christmas service in here, and John had asked me to be one of the helpers during the service, and I was dressed in the white robe, and my parents were standing right up in that corner. And anytime they come into this room, I can still see up there. And that them looking at me saying, what is she doing? But looking at me and trusting that I was a bright person and I wouldn't do anything strange, especially with my children. And after the service, seeing how proud they were of me and what had happened, the courage that it took to bring us to this place. And while at this place, both times, there are two things. There's one thing that I always took from Holden, and that was a sense of hospitality. That the first time I was here, the staff with Linda, we were very caring staff. You never stood in line that someone wasn't rubbing your back or holding your hand or just being in contact with you. Something that I gravely missed when I left here was human contact. Now, if you would go into the city and you're standing in line and you start to rub your hand, it doesn't translate. But so a hospitality. The second time I was here, Elizabeth Westland was the hospitality person. Elizabeth always made sure that there was something gorgeous in the fire pit, that there were flowers on the table, and there was a sense that whoever you were coming into the village, you were loved by Elizabeth. And that is, I think, one of the greatest gifts that I saw and was able to take away from Holden, was that gift of caring for whoever you were, whether you were tall or squat or wide or narrow, whether you were black or red or pink or blue. Elizabeth was there, and she just had this such a sweet way about her of greeting you and talking to you and making you feel like you were a very important person. So when I went down lake, down mountain, down hill, cross country, back to home, hospitality was something that I knew that I had to take with me. In 2000, I finished studying at seminary and was going on for another degree, and God started the tapping. Had started it about a year before. It was the tapping. I was working with homeless families for the Council of Churches, an overnight program, emergency shelter program that I helped to develop for them. And but I was going on to work on a PhD because in seminary I found that there wasn't a strong sense of ministry for people in poverty or homeless people. And I felt that if I could teach that to young pastors, that it would be a greater way of getting God's message out to more people. So I was ready. I was had sent off to Union for some information and to whatever it is in California and to Georgia. And I kept saying to my girlfriend, how do I look in New York? How do I look in California? And she would just look at me and I said, I don't look good there, do I? She would say, what about home? And I said, oh, you know, home, I'm ready for another adventure. My kids were, Annie, my baby had just, she and I got my master's and she got her BA in the same year. So she was kind of, you know, spreading her wings and leaving the nest, and so I thought, okay, I can go someplace again. Still with this sense of knowing that I had to ask God for guidance. When I got my job at the Council of Churches, I had had the dubious distinction of being fired from a previous job, and someone told me, you're not worth your salt until you are fired from someplace. So I'm worth my salt now because I have been fired. And I sat there and I said, okay, God, I can't find the job for myself. You have to find it for me. And that was in May. And my unemployment was due to run out at the end of October. And at the end of October, the Council of Churches, middle of October, the Council of Churches called me and said I didn't get the job that I applied for. And I called them back and I said, but I have to work for you. And the executive director said, well, what am I supposed to do? I said, I don't know, but I'm supposed to work for you. I know that. And a couple weeks later, he said, well, I do have a job, and it's developing a program for emergency shelter for families. It's kind of a loose structure. We don't quite know what we're doing. We were taking over from another organization. And he said, do you think you can do it? I said, sure. He said, have you done this before? I said, no. I said, but I know how to develop program. I know how to do that, so I can do it. And when I went there, it was called the homeless program. And for 2 days, I sat there at my desk saying, how can I say I'm the director of the homeless program? It didn't sound well to me. It was not a good fit. So I changed the name to Project Home. And I did that for 5 years. And in the doing of that job, still this piece of hospitality came forth that myself and the staff and the volunteers that I trained, that was utmost in the top of the list, that you had to be hospitable to the families. You had to care. You had to take into consideration their plight, that these are our mothers and fathers who don't have a place, who need to be respected, who need to be listened to, who need to be cared for, who need pretty things around them, who need to be given good snacks, who all of these things, who need clean, good linens and blankets and good mattresses to sleep on, who need all of these things, especially respect. Because so often, as people who are housed, we feel that we can talk down to people who do not have home. And that is not what you could do in my program. So, okay, I've got that developed, and it's going pretty good. And I say, okay, I'm through with seminary now. I'm going on to this other thing. And God is still doing this camping. And I say to my peers, we need a place for families to go during the day where they're safe. Now, there is a place in St. Paul, Dorothy Day, but it's basically for men and single women. It's a pretty tough place to go to. I used to have to go in there for meetings, and sometimes I go to work almost dressed like this, because I never know if I'm going to be sitting on the floor with children or cooking a meal. So oftentimes I am not suited. But when I knew I had to go into Dorothy Day, I would suit up because I needed to be able to command respect from the people who were there. If I came in like this, they would think I'm another one of the women walking in, and I didn't want to go there. So I would suit up when I went into Dorothy Day. But I would look at the families there, and I would ask the families that came to me at night, what did you do during the day? And the responses were, this one mom with a rambunctious two-year-old said, I had to hold my child's hand all day long so he wouldn't run around in the space of Dorothy Day, because I didn't know what people would do to him if he bumped into them. Would he bump into a lighted cigarette? Would he knock over someone's coffee? Another mom said she put her two daughters on the bus, the school bus, then she got on the city bus, and she rode all day long around the city so she would be warm because it was winter and fairly safe. Another mom came into me one day with a very sick child. He had the flu or something like that, and he just collapsed on the couch. And I said, what did you do all day? And she said, it was really good. The police didn't make me move off of this. We have an indoor park then. The police didn't make us move one time off of that park bench. He could lay on that park bench all day. My volunteers were saying to me, what are the families doing during the day? And I said, I am not sure, but I run a good night program. I can't be responsible for them 24 hours a day. For 12 hours, I know they're safe and they're clean and all of these things. But it was that tapping again, you know, God saying, Margaret, Margaret. And I said, God, I can't do it. I don't have the skills. You know, it takes a lot of money to run a program like that. It takes a lot of everything to run a program like that. Please, you know, let the cup go by. I just can't do this. And it was the tapping and the tapping. And finally I said, okay, but you've got to be there with me. You've got to be there with me every day, which I know God is always with me every day, but I made God make that promise to me. I'm really powerful. And we opened our doors. We opened our doors on October 21st, 2001. We've never had a time in that time our doors were closed. Sometimes families didn't show up, but we were still there. There is, with all of the staff that I hire, they understand and talk about hospitality and caring. And caring sometimes comes off as pretty tough love. I have an intake worker who understands how to get down to the base questions of life. If it's drugs, do you use? And the answer is, not very much. And she'll ask some more questions. Do you use? Well, sometimes. And she'll ask other things. And she said, the third time, where did all your money go? Well, I had to pay my drug dealer. Or I gave my money to my guy. Or other ways in which your money disappears. But she is never disrespectful. My staff is never disrespectful. 80% of my clients are this tall. We always have children because we're a family center. There's not one day that I ever have gone in there and asked the families that I work with to pray. And yet, I feel that this is a true ministry that God is asking me to do. And when I think of Holden and the gifts of Holden, it is the strength and the miracle of hospitality.
I'm Herb Palmer. My home is in Houston, Texas, and I planned a sabbatical to begin last May, May 2005. And the first 2 weeks of that sabbatical was here at Holden. I knew very little about this community. I did enjoy some of the worship resources and music from Holden. And the middle of May was before the summer session. And so it was just pretty much staff who were here. We had the May youth weekends, and so we had hundreds of youth who came during that weekend, but the staff who lived here, and they made up the Holden Village at that time for me. So like to come this week and see so many people here every day coming in and out, it's really different than my experience when I came in that May. My decision was I would do my sabbatical and study, and then I would also work, and because I worked, I became part of the staff, and so I was one with the other people who were here. And the rhythm of that time was very much like it is now. There was work and meals, worship and dishes and garbo, and everybody participated in all of those things. And I was part of the staff, we had staff meetings, and it was very apparent there was a high anxiety in the staff. And the staff was, or the community was considering calling a new pastor. Now there would be an interim pastor for a while, and then the new pastor would be called. And there was anxiety about who this person would be. Who would have a vote in deciding who that person would be? And would all the voices of the community be heard? And so it was a sense of who is the community, and who makes up the community, and whose voice is more valued, or is every voice valued as they make up the community? Those were very important questions as the Holden Village was facing some changes. They had just gone through some anticipation of new directors being chosen, and now they're going to be choosing a pastor. And the questions were that why wouldn't the staff have a voice? If the board is the one who votes, will they be influenced by what the people on site have on their minds? You have to realize the people on site come and go. There are people who come for a few weeks, a couple weeks like myself, and there are people who come for a few years. And so it was very fluid. The board was trying to create stability for the village. And so the question was, who would they get a vote? Who would represent their vote? Would they have a voice? Would they have a voice? And what would the job description be like for the pastor? And would it be a job description of being very clear of calling a pastor whose understanding of homosexuality would be one the pastor would be open and affirming? And all of that was very anxious. And you see, because some of the people, they valued the relationship they had with their pastor, and they wanted what they found here in their healing and in their hope to be a place where the staff who was hired continued to help them in that healing. What I learned from that was a process. The people in leadership didn't say this is the way it'll be, but they called together a series of meetings of staff people to say, what's on your mind? Tell us what you're thinking about. Tell us what your needs are. Tell us what your hopes are. And at least one of those sessions was tape recorded, and so that people's voice could be heard. And so it was a wonderful process of allowing people who are very anxious about this, the future of this place to have something to say about it, and to trust that the board would hear what they had to say. And so I appreciated that process. And it opened to my understanding about inclusivity. And inclusivity also means including voices of people people that we may forget, people who may be a minority voice, people who don't have the power or authority or have been invested with that. And that was a huge learning curve for me, because I'm in a position where I'm a pastor, and there are lots of decisions made in our community that affect people's lives. And it made me think about whose voices aren't being heard. Who are the minority voices in our community? How do the decisions that we make impact people that we have forgotten about that need to have a voice in this? What I want to do is to make it in my ministry to create a process where people's voices can be heard, and to seek out who needs to be heard in these decisions, and also to say, I have a voice that I need to share my voice, and sometimes that's a minority voice, and to put that out there as well. Our congregation is going through some changes, and it's a very anxious time for our people to talk about how to incorporate those changes, and when there are changes, those changes include me? And that's what a lot of people are asking. Will I still be part of this community? And we have recently gone through a process of talking about some changes and created a forum for people to speak and said, come and be part of the decision making. I appreciate Holden. I had that surprise of an experience.
My name is Kristen Anstett. I'm from Seattle. And this was my childhood family vacation, was to come up to Holden, and we kind of alternated winter and summer. And when I got to college, I was old enough to come and volunteer, so I came up a couple summers. And then when I graduated college, I graduated with a degree in education, but I was, I don't know, 22, maybe 23, and I wanted to teach high schoolers. So I knew I was not ready to be a teacher yet. I couldn't be like 4 years older than my students. I would be a joke in the classroom. And I knew that being a teacher was also being a social worker and a parent, disciplinarian. These were things that I did not have these qualities. So my mother was telling me, oh, you should teach. You'll be such a good teacher. You should start teaching. You should teach. And I, just because I can doesn't mean I should, was my mantra. After graduating from college, like, oh, I filled out applications and I never sent them in. I went to work at Payless Shoes with my roommate of the time, and then we went to work graveyard at the post office. It was like, you know, what can I do to not teach? And then I decided, well, summer's rolling around, maybe I'll go up to Holden again. This is kind of a good place to come for summer. I've been up here before in summer, and I actually came up in May. So I got the same experience of, I kind of got a taste of the winter community. And that was sort of enticing. And it was something I'd always toyed with. It was very hard in the summers during college to go home. I always wanted to stay, you know. I hear a lot of people talk, oh, I wanted to just quit school and stay at Holden for a year. But so I spent the summer here doing minors, junior minors, and then I decided to stay the whole year. And I was really fortunate to become the TA in the schoolhouse, which is Narnia, during the winter years. So it's a two-room schoolhouse. And I got to work with two fabulous teachers, which I believe really helped me sort of see what teaching could be and what it was. And while I was up here, I sort of also realized that I'm trying to learn how to be an adult. I was trying to figure out what it meant to be in the world. And I think Holden was fabulous for that, because I learned how to be an adult in a very global community. It's a very small community at Holden, but I kept hearing the words social justice, things with environmentalism. They weren't foreign to me because, of course, my parents had been influenced by Holden and brought me up here. So they weren't foreign, but I was starting to learn them in a different way as an adult and kind of see these issues, which really just opened my eyes. It was fabulous. I also, while I was up here during the summers, had the fortunate experience to meet a high schooler who had been up at Holden as a boarding student, And she was, I was just blown away with how mature she was. She was very well-spoken. I could tell she'd spent a whole winter up here with a very intergenerational community. She knew how to talk to everybody. She knew how to deal with the kids, you know, who were in elementary school with her, and she knew how to speak to people who were, you know, 70 and 80. And I was blown away by this ability, and I thought, oh, definitely this is Holden's influence on her life. I came up the next summer, and I ran into her again up here, and she had been out in a regular public school. It was a little saddened because while she still was a very mature teenager, she was very much a teenager in the way she spoke, the way she dressed, what she was talking about. I could tell she'd sort of been in an outside school, and I was thinking, oh, it's kind of unfortunate. But I know that her experience up here stuck with her, but I was thinking, well, you know, I'd like to teach high school age students, and I can see what Holden can do for a student when they're up here as a boarding student. And I thought, well, you know, if I go teach, this can be my opportunity to sort of be Holden for my students. So I finally decided to go into teaching after I spent a year up here as a TA. And that first year was very trying, and I only stayed a year. But then I found the position I'm in now, and so I teach at an alternative high school. It's very small. The classes are 90 minutes. My biggest class, the class I cringe at, is 22 students. That's a lot of students for me, which normally in a normal high school you could have up to 34 students. I've had a class as small as 4. A usual class is about 16. It's this ideal size of a group to talk to, and I really get to know my students. So they asked us to bring an object up with us to help us be a catalyst, and so I decided the object I would bring up, I had sort of been steeped in this environmentalism and social justice while I was up at Holden. I thought, oh, these are great things to teach, and I had teach U.S. history, but then I also get to teach geography. And if you have not read it yet, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight by Tom Hartman is an incredible book. It's fabulous. You should read it. And I've marked it thoroughly because I use it in my geography class all the time, sort of as a way to get my students to realize what are the environmental issues we're looking at. You know, yes, you need to know where Afghanistan is on a map because it's embarrassing that you don't. But there are a lot of other issues, too, that we need to start thinking about in the future. And my students generally are very interested and very shocked. They don't get this conversation at home, generally. They don't watch the news. They're like 15, 16. Some of them do. But so I found that, you know, sort of the environmentalism that I had learned at Holden, I get to share with my students, which is fabulous. Fast Food Nation, if you haven't read this, this is a fabulous book to read. And it's the darker side of the all-American meal, and he sort of focuses on meat, but he also talks about potatoes and kind of mentions chicken and how politics ties into all this, which is very interesting. And my students also they come into my room with a Coke and Cheetos, and that's their breakfast, and they run to McDonald's during lunch. And I don't think they get this conversation at home, and I had been at Holden, and my mom's cooking, of course, was influenced by Holden, so we had a lot of lentils growing up, and, you know, all the different sort of things she learned from Holden. So I kind of got to see that, oh, I could share some health issues with my students. I could talk about, so I also teach U.S. history, so I read them a little bit of The Jungle, which was written about 1904, and it was uncovering the horrible, gross things that were going on in the meatpacking industry in Chicago. You know, rats on the meat and dead cows being mixed in with all, you know, just. So anyway, my students are shocked. You know, 1904, oh, that's so, stop, you have to go to lunch, you know. And then we read a section of this, and, you know, oh, this was published in 2004, I think 2003, and it's not all that different, and it's a little bit shocking, and students are sort of, their eyes are opened, and I feel like, oh, this one's also marked up. Because I read a lot of that. I had the fabulous opportunity last year of teaching sociology. Nobody else in the district teaches it, so it's pretty much whatever I wanted to do, I got to do. And so I got to bring in a lot of social justice issues. So I brought up global women, nannies, maids, and sex workers in the new economy. And it was, I haven't finished this book yet, but sort of the idea of social justice in the world, and that I could actually open this up to my students. And once a week at Holden, there's a hunger awareness campaign. So you would have a potato or rice. It was a very simple meal to recognize that not everybody in the world has, you know, the three-course meal that we have, a moment to recognize that other people are suffering. And after the hunger awareness meal, there was always a letter writing campaign. So someone would put together a campaign, and after lunch you could go over and you could write a letter and mail it off to your representative or senator or president. So I thought, well, I'll do a letter writing campaign with my students. So we talked about genocide, and so many of them had not even heard of Saddam. Oh, I'm emotional, I don't know why. Or Darfur, and I just thought that was amazing. So I put together a letter writing campaign. This was really powerful to me, I guess. I didn't realize. So they wrote to Bush, or their representative or senator if they want. Most of them wrote to Bush. And I talked about how to write a good letter and be respectful and say what you'd like. And they wrote a letter, and the next quarter after these students were gone, they started coming up to me, oh, I got a response. I got a response to my letter, you know. It's a form letter, nothing personal, but it was sort of, it was great for them to figure out how they could be active, and they could sort of be a part of social justice, so, yeah.
Thanks for the people who shared stories. Are there, I don't know how we're doing for time, but are there other people who have a story, either part of the convocation or part of the audience like to share?
Well, by our pastor coming up here, and for a week or so, he brought back the Holden Vespers, and we used that during the Lenten service, and it was very wonderful to hear, and that got me interested in coming.
Carol, how are we doing for time?
Down.
Go for another 10 or 15 minutes, what was that? Okay, well, are there other stories people would like to share here who maybe are part of the convocation or maybe just visiting? Other kinds of dialogue, or it's pretty much, this is great.
Well, I'm Lucy Forster-Smith. I'm another person like Paul that's on the research team, as well as Gary Hesser and Chris Johnson over there. And also, we'd be very happy to not only hear stories, but if you have any questions about the kind of process we're using for this. I know several people have approached me this week and asked the question about the research project itself. So we could either do that here, or want to certainly invite you to feel real free to approach any of the four of us in terms of any questions that you have about what we're doing this with this, what are we discovering so far. It's very early still in our process, but what are we discovering, and what is the plan sort of in the way that we hope to be able to shape this. So you don't necessarily have to do this here tonight, but just to let you know that we're very open and very happy to discuss it with people along the way. It's been amazing so far, the process has been, and this week has just been very eye-opening and emotional and powerful in terms of the kind of way that bringing together people with such a remarkable history with this place, and to be able to really and also the kind of range of experiences people have had. So just want to open the way on that.
Otherwise,
and tape clips, but we can do it.
Thanks for the people who presented.
Thank you.
Thank you.